calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations all across the United States, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, CRN Digital. All sorts of ways you can get this program. Welcome to our show, 6 minutes after the hour. Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels is with us. He is in Montreal at the moment, are you not? Greg, Mayor Nickels?
Good morning or good afternoon.
Yeah, as the case may be, it's wherever folks are, and you are in Montreal at the climate summit.
I am. I've been participating here since Sunday and interacting with mayors and other municipal officials from other parts of the world and telling the story of what we are doing in the United States, even in the absence of federal action. And learning from those cities what they're doing to combat this huge challenge.
Mayor Nickels, do you think the rest of the world is going to succeed in stopping the U.S. from destroying the planet? I mean, here we are, 4 or 5% of the world's population. We're producing a quarter of the planet's greenhouse gases. That has to be a major subject of discussion there.
It is, and I don't think it's going to be the rest of the world that's going to stop us. I think it's going to be the people of the United States who are going to make it clear to this administration and to the next that we expect the United States not just to join the community of nations in reversing this trend of climate disruption, but that it is inevitable that we will help lead this effort in the future.
For our listeners who are not familiar with the situation right now, in Montreal, approximately 10,000 representatives from 189 countries, environmental groups, and businesses worldwide meeting in Montreal, started on November 28th. It's running through December 9th. And to talk about how to continue the fight against global warming when the provisions of the Kyoto Protocol end in 2012. And Mayor Nickels, as the mayor of Seattle, Washington, I understand that you've been involved in helping Seattle be a little more progressive than, shall we say, the rest of the United States in some of these regards.
Well, you know, the what we've done in Seattle really is twofold. First, we've taken local action. Our municipal government, which is about 10,500 employees and, you know, all the services you expect from your city, we've reduced our greenhouse gas emissions from the government by 60% from 1990 levels.
And wow. Now, that's much better than the Kyoto Protocol calls.
That's much better. But remember, the Kyoto Protocols are just a start. They literally are the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And it will take action far beyond that. What's significant about Kyoto is it's the first time that the community of nations have gotten together and taken concrete action to change that trend. And that's very significant, but it's only a beginning. So we've taken action within our government. We now are taking local action to include our business community, people in their homes, so that our community as a whole meets or exceeds Kyoto. And then on February 16th, when Kyoto became the law in 141 countries, I challenged mayors across the country to join with me in taking that similar kind of local action. So I would challenge the Seattle being unique in this regard, because 192 mayors have joined me in pledging to take local action. And we believe that by making it clear that you can do this, and you can do it without huge disruption to the economy, we make it inevitable that the federal government will join and will ultimately help lead this effort.
Well, I would think if you've reduced your greenhouse gas emissions in Seattle through your government functions, government vehicles and whatnot, by 60%, that you've actually saved money since you've got to burn fossil fuels to produce that stuff.
We have. You know, there's an initial investment you have to make. We now have the largest portfolio of green buildings, of what are called LEED certified buildings, in the country, followed closely by Portland and Chicago. There's an initial investment, but over time, the savings in energy, the savings in water is huge. Similarly with our vehicles. As gas prices go up, as diesel prices go up, we've actually found at times that biodiesel fuel that we've converted to is cheaper than conventional diesel fuel. And, of course, it's more sustainable. It will be something our children and our grandchildren can use and not have the kind of huge change in quality of life that climate disruption will bring.
You use the magic word investment. So much of the political dialogue today in the United States, dominated by people who want to try to They say cut taxes. I would say they're simply borrowing money from our children and grandchildren and giving them giving that money to the wealthiest of Americans right now. But you know, not to put too sharp a political edge on this thing, but so much of the rhetoric coming out of these folks these days is that when government spends money, for example, like you're talking about in Seattle, of upgrading the internal infrastructure, whether it's moving to vehicles that are that produce less carbon emissions or investing in green buildings, anything like that, they call it an expense. And you know, and try and say, you know, should we be have this expense or should we reduce taxes? And when you look at, you know, expenses versus taxes, then, you know, gee, most people would say, you know, we'd really rather not have an expense. But in reality, what we're talking about here is not, by and large, are not expenses. We're talking about investments.
Absolutely. And if you look at the cost of the short-sighted policies that we have, they're huge. If you think about them in a broader sense, for instance, the fact that we as a country are so dependent on foreign oil, it is time for the United States to have a new Independence Day where we develop our own renewable sources of energy that we rely on rather than importing oil. Because the cost of war to protect those sources of oil is huge in human and economic terms, and we can't afford it any longer. We need to invest in order to protect our national security, in order to protect the quality of life that our children and grandchildren have. And I think the people of the United States are far ahead of the politicians in understanding that at a real gut sense.
Well, and a few of the politicians like yourself are there with us and much appreciated. We're speaking with Mayor Greg Nickels, Mayor of Seattle, Washington, one of approximately 10,000 representatives from 189 countries, environmental groups, and businesses around the world meeting this week in Montreal, Canada, to talk about how to continue the fight against global warming and what to do when Kyoto runs out in 2012, which so many other countries in the world have signed on to. What's happening at the conference there, Mayor Nickels?
Well, the first meeting for me was with mayors from around the world. It was the initial meeting of the World Mayors Council on Climate Change. And so the mayor of Bonn, Germany, was the chair. The mayor of Montreal, as our host, was there. Representatives and mayors and deputy mayors from a dozen countries that have shown leadership in this area were there. And we began a conversation about how we will support each other, how we will share information about what works, what doesn't work, and how we will affect our national governments in moving forward on the commitments made in Kyoto in many cases, or in our case, to get our country on board.
Are these conversations in the context of, you know, shall we pass rules, laws, treaties, that sort of thing, or are they more in the context of, here's what worked for us, maybe it can work for you, you know, sharing ideas and things?
Mayors are, you know, very much nose to the grindstone people. We're right there on the front line. You know, when I tell people you have to recycle, it affects them in their kitchen. When I tell people that you can't shower as long, it affects them in the bathroom. So we're much less about talk and much more about direct action within our communities. And so it was a very practical conversation about how we can spread that message and how we can work with our federal governments to give us the tools to be able to meet this huge challenge that the climate disruption presents to us, mm-hmm. and which affects our people most directly.
And how is the United States being represented, Mayor Greg Nickels of Seattle, at this conference?
Well, there's a real dichotomy. Our national government is an observer, since we are not a signatory on the treaty. And our national government is being obstructionist in that role as observer. Refusing to acknowledge, for instance, that an increase in a foot of water in the ocean will wipe out small islands in the South Pacific. But the United States is represented more broadly by cities and non-governmental organizations and just plain interested people, sending the message to people around the world that the people of the United States understand this is a problem, and the people of the United States will ensure that we will step up to our obligations.
Great. Well, I'm very pleased that you're there representing, you know, us in the United States, you and others from the United States, and boy, 190 some odd mayors you've had set across?
92 mayors thus far representing 40 million people in 38 states.
Just in the United States?
Yes.
That is absolutely marvelous. Well, congratulations and thanks for being there, sir. Seattle Mayor Greg Nichols in Montreal, Canada. Thanks so much for being there with us. We're going to take a break here in just a second. When we come back from this break, I got to tell you, we have figured it out. What's going on with the war on Christmas rhetoric? Why has Fox News been flogging this war on Christmas? Why has Bill O'Reilly been flogging the war on Christmas? All of a sudden, it makes sense. It's so elegant and so dastardly. It's amazing. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yeah, democracy. We'd like a little democracy here. Indeed, we'd like democracy right now. Don't you get it? Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where smart people get their news. News without conflicts of global corporate interest, where we dare to ask that incredible question, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, nope, don't think so. Okay, well, here now the rest of the story.
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yep, behind enemy lines, what the right is really up to. You've been hearing this whole war on Christmas thing. Ironically, yesterday Laura Bush did her thing in the White House, Laura and George. Never once mentioned Christmas. She said, I hope you all have happy holidays when the reporters were all, when the guests were leaving. Their Christmas card does not say Christmas card. It says holiday card. All that kind of stuff. That should, you would think, get Bill O'Reilly with his panties in a wad all hysterical. It doesn't, of course, being the partisan Republican that he is. So why is Fox News flogging this meme of a war against Christmas if they really don't mind when people talk about happy holidays and are respectful of the fact that not everybody celebrates Christmas in the United States, even though everybody pays taxes? All of us citizens, everybody might not be all that happy with promoting an official state religion, which is, by the way, banned in the First Amendment of the Constitution. Well, now it comes out. David Kirkpatrick lays the thing out in the New York Times today. He says, it's the time of year when bedtime stories and television specials often recall that plucky reindeer. You remember Rudolph? Or that little girl of Whoville who saved Christmas? See, in order to save Christmas, Christmas has to be under assault. You have to have a Grinch who's, attacking Christmas, or you have to, Santa in trouble. There has to be a problem in order for there to be a solution, right? So the conservatives, they create a problem. Christmas under assault. And now they have a solution. The solution? Judge Samuel A. Alito, Jr. I kid you not. The Committee for Justice. Yeah, right. No, seriously, that's their name. Starting Monday, it's going to be running ads in Colorado, Wisconsin, and West Virginia, states whose senators are considered pivotal votes on Judge Alito, writes Kirkpatrick in the New York Times. Ads which say, and I quote, liberal groups like People for the American Way and the ACLU have opposed public Christmas and Hanukkah displays and even fought to keep Christmas carols out of school. Some courts and judges have supported this radical agenda, but not Judge Sam Alito. There you go. Sam Alito. He's going to save Christmas. That's what's going on. Fidelis, the conservative Roman Catholic group, writes Kirkpatrick, has begun an internet advertisement and plans to buy radio commercials with a similar theme as early as next week. They will say, here's a narrator talking about Alito upholding a Jersey City display, including a nativity scene. Judge Alito ruled against the ACLU's attempt to scrub away our religious heritage. Yeah. Jay Sekulow, chief counsel of the Christian Conservative American Law Center for Law and Justice, and a guy being paid by the White House presumably with your and my tax dollars, to coordinate support for their nominees. Guy is also, by the way, the host of a Christian radio program. He says his organization is going to send out 850,000 email messages to their supporters to ask them to help Judge Alito save Christmas. Suddenly it makes sense. You know, here we thought it was just, you know, a little latent anti-Semitism or a little weirdness or an opportunistic thing. No, this is part of the campaign to get Alito nominated. This is, it's called, you terrify the base and then you give them the solution. Kirkpatrick notes the effort coincides with an unusually vigorous campaign by allied groups like the American Family Association and Focus on the Family to pressure retail chains to mention Christmas specifically. It's all part of the thing. Denny Hastert, we now have the Christmas tree instead of the holiday tree. Now, let me just, you know, for the record, frankly, even though the tree is being lit with my tax dollars, and I don't think that any religion should play a role in government, I have no problem with calling the Christmas tree a Christmas tree because no other religion has got a tree as their thing. I mean, I think we should have a Christmas menorah and we should have a Christmas, you know, whatever the Kwanzaa thing is, and if there is, and we should have, you know, pick your religion, it should be out there. But it's really a secular thing in many regards in that context. But you know, the whole thing of Christmas under attack, and therefore, Reverend Barry Lynn, I think, has said it best. He says, if they think that hitching Sam Alito to Santa's sleigh is going to eliminate serious issues about his regard for the Constitution, I think they're mistaken. And that's the bottom line. Don't look at the fact that Sam Alito wants to take away your rights under the Constitution, your right to free speech, your right to free assembly, your right not to have your home invaded by the Gestapo, by the police departments and the FBI and whatnot, police agencies in the United States. Don't look at the fact that Sam Alito thinks that American citizens should be able to be put in prison without ever seeing a lawyer and without even being charged with a crime. Don't look at the fact that Sam Alito supports the United States having concentration camps. Don't look at any of that stuff. Instead, just think of him as the guy who's going to save Christmas. Gallup poll. 88% of respondents said it's a good idea to wish people Merry Christmas, even if it offends those who do not celebrate. So here they go. They've been doing their polling. They've figured it out. Sam Alito, the man who saved Christmas. That's how they're going to sell this guy for the Supreme Court. Amazing. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, look out, Republicans. Look out, cons. Here, come in 2006. I'll tell you, the American people are waking up. They are saying enough of this already. Welcome back to our program, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour here, Tom Hartman with you. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception on the place where despair is not an option. You got to get active. Absolutely got to get active.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, indeed. If Tom DeLay runs for re-election in 2006, this is the question in a Gallup poll. In general, are you more likely to vote for the Republican candidate Tom DeLay or for the Democratic Party's candidate for Congress? This in DeLay's own district. DeLay versus an unknown generic Democrat. DeLay 36%, the Democrat 49%. Is your view a favorable or unfavorable for Tom DeLay? 52% unfavorable. Amazing. Based on what you've heard or read, do you think the charges against DeLay are definitely true, probably true, probably not true, or definitely not true? In the definitely true and probably true category, 55%. This is DeLay's own district, the 22nd District of Texas, Congressional District of Texas. Now, what's fascinating is how the headlines were handled this. Yahoo email alert, breaking news. First sentence, Texas judge has refused to dismiss money laundering charges against Representative Tom DeLay, but threw out conspiracy charges. Right? This is, you know, from yesterday. But what's interesting is how it got handled. So the Yahoo breaking news, the Associated Press, basically. This is the AP story. They talk about he refused to dismiss money laundering charges, but threw out the conspiracy charges. CNN, Breaking news. Judge tosses conspiracy charges against ex-House Majority Leader but allows money laundering charges, according to AP. And finally, we report you decide the Fox News alert. I will read you the headline in its entirety. Texas judge drops conspiracy charges against Representative Tom DeLay. Period. End of sentence. That's it. And so Dick Cheney goes down to, now they have planned this thing for a month or more, to go down for this fundraiser for Tom DeLay. He's showing up for the Tom DeLay fundraiser. And I think everybody thought, you know, they had finally they found a judge. They went through a couple of judges. Said, well, we can't have that judge. He was a Democrat. We can't have that judge. He took money from Democrats. They finally had, you know, brought this guy out of retirement to be the judge in DeLay's case, you know, dusted him off, propped him up in his chair and said, okay, you got to help us, you know, whatever. And in my opinion, Dick Cheney really must have believed that yesterday all of the charges were going to be thrown out. Because, I mean, this is humiliating. He shows up for a fundraiser for Tom DeLay the day that the charges are reaffirmed. Yes, the conspiracy charges were thrown out, but the money laundering charge reaffirmed. Protesters, the Associated Press, Juan Lozano, writes, protesters bearing signs that read, the GOP is in an ethics free fall and chance of, hey, hey, ho, ho, Dick Cheney has to go, greeted Vice President Dick Cheney as he stopped in Houston on Monday to speak at a campaign fundraiser for embattled U.S. Representative Tom DeLay. Cheney spoke to more than 300 Republican supporters, many local political leaders, who paid anywhere from $500 to $4,200 each to attend the private fundraiser. John Cornyn and Kay Bailey Hutchinson were scheduled to attend, but they had the good sense to stay in Washington, D.C. See, Cheney was the headliner. He couldn't get out of it. The media was not allowed to attend the event, and the protesters were kept hundreds of feet away from the hotel in a so-called free speech zone. So there's Tom DeLay, our Tom DeLay update for the day. Just want to wrap up this thing with Sam Alito, by the way. Sam is coming to save Christmas. They point out in the emails and in the ad campaign that he ruled in favor of allowing local governments to set up nativity scenes. He ruled against a school district that wanted to prevent an evangelical group from sending flyers home to elementary students. Now, consider this for a moment. This Christian evangelical group goes to a school district and says, we want you to take these religious flyers. We want you to give them to the kids at this state-paid public school and have the kids take them home. And the school said no. The evangelical group sued, took it all the way up to the appeals court. At the appeals court level, Alito ruled that the school did not have the authority to say no to the evangelical group. I wonder how he would have ruled if instead of being a local Christian church, it had been the local Satanist sect or the local order of Druids, you know, some, let's say, unpopular religion. Certainly he doesn't seem to be any fan of true free speech rights and civil rights in the United States. In fact, former Republican Senate aide Manuel Miranda, no relation to the famous decision, who is helping coordinate the conservative judicial confirmation campaigns, says he's been urging, this from the New York Times, he's been urging groups for months to play up Judge Alito's religion decisions. He says, and this is the key of the whole thing, he says it's something the other side can't really join, in other words, fight against, or debate, because they come out looking like the Grinch. Incredible. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. In just a minute, I want to get into some of this stuff about free trade and the national security implications of it as well. First, Danny in Wyethville, West Virginia on the line. Hey, Danny, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Hey, I just wanted to ask you about something you said last week about Posse Comitatus.
Yes, sir.
You were talking about, you know, it was created in the 1870s in the wake of the Civil War. Legislation stating that American forces will never turn their guns on American citizens, right?
Yeah, that's a good summary. I don't remember the exact year, but it was during Reconstruction after the Civil War, yeah.
Yeah, and then later, a little bit later, you were talking about, you gave a great example of what if there was a terrorist attack, say, oh, conveniently about a month before the elections, what's to stop George Bush from declaring martial law, suspending elections? Man, I was thinking about that all weekend. My question is, I just need to know what exactly entails martial law, and what wouldn't posse comitatus stop that, or is it two different things? And then I'll hang up on this. Appreciate it.
Yeah, okay. Donnie, thanks, thanks a lot for the call and for asking the question. The short answer is that, at least based on the discussions that we can find from the White House tapes from Nixon and Kissinger, Nixon issued one of the first executive orders saying that if the president declares a state of emergency, that posse comitatus can be suspended. In any case, you go back to those White House tapes, and Nixon was actually talking about declaring a state of emergency in order to stop the Watergate investigations. And Kissinger kind of talked him down from that, and he ended up resigning instead. But my take on it, and I'm not a constitutional attorney, but we've had several of them on this program, my take on it is that if there was an attack on this country or another biological, don't forget, we still have no idea, at least you and I have no idea, who it was who sent the anthrax out. If there was an attack in this country, George Bush conceivably could declare a state of emergency. He's actually, and this is what should give us all pause, he's actually come out and said that it would be his intent to do that and to lock down communities and to mobilize the army within the United States in the event of an emergency caused by bird flu. And so, and there's like not much debate going on about this. And I really, I am not, and don't want to sound like, one of those late-night conspiracy nut guys or one of the, for that matter, the John Birch Society people who are, who for 40 years have been waiting, 60 years have been waiting for this kind of thing to happen. On the right and on the left, you've got people who are, look out, the government is coming, look out, the corporations are coming. But Bush is talking about this out loud. So I think that we have, some legitimate concerns here. And what concerns me most is not so much what Bush is saying, because that's sort of to be expected. What concerns me most is that there's not a debate about this in Congress. This is the whole point of a representative democracy. Our elected officials should be discussing these issues. How do we deal with an emergency? How do we deal, for example, with a pandemic? How would we deal with it if, dirty bomb was to go off in a major American city or several of them in several cities, or if they were to blow up some of these chemical plants or nuclear plants that the 9/11 Commission begged this administration to protect, and this administration said, no, we're not going to protect them. And the question for me is still out there. Why? Why have, there's people making political hay with the Bush administration gets a D and an F, they get failing grades on the 41 points that the 9/11 Commission made. Setting aside the flaws of the 9/11 Commission, which we discussed yesterday on this program, why has the Bush administration not implemented common sense things that are not particularly expensive when you consider the money that they're throwing at things like, Halliburton's fees in Iraq? I mean, $8.5 billion is missing in Iraq. That's how much has vanished. That is almost twice as much as it would cost to check all the cargo on all inbound ships into the United States at their ports of entry to make sure that nobody's trying to smuggle a dirty nuclear radiological weapon or other kind of weapon into the United States. That's five, six, seven times what it would cost to check all of the cargo on all the planes in the United States. That's just the amount that's vanished during Paul Bremer's reign in Iraq. Why are they not doing this? And I just, I haven't heard a decent answer. Haven't heard a decent answer. And I'm concerned about it. Very concerned about it. And I think all Americans should be, and we should be encouraging our elected officials, our members of Congress and our members of the Senate, to be having this discussion. Because in all probability, there will be some sort of a crisis. I mean, that's just the nature of life. Over time, countries face crises. And, we saw the abuses of power during World War I under Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat. We saw abuses of power under Franklin Roosevelt, rounding up the Japanese and putting them in internment camps during World War II. We should have had that discussion in advance. Lincoln, suspending habeas corpus. What are we going to do next time? 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back, my friends. Indeed, 9 minutes before the hour. Working class heroes, definitely something to be. Italy now accusing the CIA of ruining their investigations into terrorists. Armando Spataro, the lead prosecutor in Milan, Italy, says that if Abu Omar had not been kidnapped, he would be in prison right now. Who's Abu Omar? He's a suspected terrorist who was walking around the streets of Milan. The Italian intelligence service was looking for him. In fact, they had him in their sights, as it were. They get a message from the CIA saying they've got reliable information about him, that he's fled to an unknown location in the Balkans. So stop looking. Yeah, stop looking. Well, turns out the CIA's tip, according to an article by Craig Whitlock in the LA Times and the Washington Post Service, CIA's tip was a deliberate lie. The intelligence service of the United States deliberately lying to an ally, to the government of Italy. Turned out that we had actually kidnapped this guy and that we were holding him in one of our secret prisons in Europe or someplace. And the Italians want to know, okay, who's snatching people off the streets of Italy? And why are you screwing up our terror investigations? We have been fighting terrorists in this country for centuries. The Italians understand how to do this. They dealt with, you know, every the Red Brigades. Remember that? The whole thing with, you know, when the former prime minister of Italy got snatched off the state. They know how to fight terrorism and do it successfully. I mean, fighting terrorism in Europe goes back literally 1,000 years. You define the people as criminals. You bring all the power of the criminal justice system against them. You do not make them heroes. So therefore, you deny them public support. The exact opposite of what Bush has done. Incredibly destructive way. Bush has made Osama bin Laden into a hero for almost 1 billion people around the world. A hero. He's a warrior. See, and Bush has done it for his own political purposes. This is the tragedy. Bill Clinton could have turned Timothy McVeigh into some sort of, you know, oh, it's a giant conspiracy. We've got to crack down. Okay, we've got to suspend Posse Comitatus. We've got to suspend habeas corpus. We've got to crack down on all these groups all around America. We've got to have a Patriot Act. I mean, he could have done that. It was a major terrorist incident, blowing up the federal building in Oklahoma City, killing a couple hundred people. Instead, what Bill Clinton did was he said, this guy is nuts. He is a psychopathic killer. We need to arrest him. We need to put him in prison. And if the laws of the state provide for it, put him to death. And that's exactly what they did. And the people in Oklahoma City got some closure. But George Bush's advisors understood the story of Superman. They understood the story of good fiction. I mean, the basic, just the core stuff. The Robert McKee and all the other good screenwriting teachers out there, your hero can only be as good as the bad guy is bad. This is the core concept in fiction. What makes a novel powerful is not the hero. It's never the hero. It's the bad guy. Special Agent Starling would be nothing if she didn't have to deal with Hannibal Lecter. as the hero can only be as good as the bad guy is bad. And so for George Bush to turn himself into Super George in order to become something other than a guy who really wasn't elected president of the United States and who people were openly questioning his legitimacy, in order for him to turn himself into a superhero, he had to have a super evil villain on the other side. Superman would be a boring story if there was no Lex Luthor. Batman would be a boring story without the Joker and the Riddler, without super enemies. And George Bush had to have a super enemy. So instead of defining Osama bin Laden as simply a criminal, which he was, and devoting the efforts of the world to tracking him down and bringing him to justice, which could have happened, the entire world was with us. Everybody, including the Muslim world, was ready to help us bring this guy to justice. Instead of doing that, George Bush had to elevate him to the status of arch-villain so that George Bush could be the superhero. And it worked for a couple of years. But it's not working anymore. And the Italians, the Europeans in general, you got Condi Rice over in Germany right now, the Europeans are looking at us going, we saw this movie before. We saw it when Hitler tried to elevate all the various groups, particularly the Jews, but all the other groups that he persecuted into serious international threats. They're terrorists. The burning of the Reichstagsgebäude by Marius van der Lubbe in February of 1933, and Hitler saying, "This is an act of terror. This is a sign from God. We will not allow this to stand," and declared a war on terrorism. The people of Europe, they're saying, "We've seen this movie before, and we don't want to see it again." And now the Italians, charging 22 CIA operatives, including the head of the CIA Milan substation, with kidnapping and other crimes, and issuing arrest warrants for them, and saying, hey, if you guys hadn't snatched this Abu Omar guy, we'd have him in prison, we'd have him in a trial, and we'd have broken this thing up. You're screwing up our terror investigations. And sure enough, we are. But it's politically useful to the Bush administration, even if it doesn't help stop terrorism, as the 9/11 Commission just pointed out. What a tragedy. What a farce. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the second hour of our regular daily three-hour program, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, here 6 minutes past the hour. The radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Time for our Bioneers segment. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. And today, Paul Anastas is with us. Paul, am I pronouncing your name right?
Yes, you are.
Paul Anastas, director of the Green Chemistry Institute in Washington, D.C. Paul, what is green chemistry? And greenchemistryinstitute.org, the website, by the way. What is green chemistry?
Well, green chemistry is the design of chemical products and chemical processes that reduce or eliminate the use and generation of hazardous substances.
Now, I've noticed, Paul, that, for example, there is a cleaning substance that's basically orange oil, oil of orange and oil of grapefruit, that is just incredibly effective stuff. It smells nice. I'm assuming it's not terribly toxic. You don't want to get it in your eyes or anything like that. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about, using natural substances that naturally biodegrade and naturally break down and yet are very effective at cutting grease or whatever? Or is this much more subtle than that?
Well, that's one very good example. The lessons that nature can teach us, the lessons that we can learn from biology, just the natural products that we come across all the time, is one wonderful approach to green chemistry. But it does go far deeper than that. You'll notice that in my definition of green chemistry, we're talking about the design of chemical products and processes. Mm-hmm. Because now scientists can actually design molecules so that they won't be harmful to humans or to the environment, to the whole biosphere.
Well,
it's really an exciting time.
Yeah, this raises the question, though, how do you know? I mean, for example, if we're using extract of orange peel juice or oil or whatever, we know that humans have interacted with oranges for, you know, millions of years, humans and our ancestors. And so we've had plenty of time to develop immunities or whatever to the stuff that's in the orange that might be toxic to fruit flies or whatever. I mean, there's a reason why most of these plants produce these aromatic substances. Some of them are to draw, you know, pollinators and things, but a lot of them are actually pesticides or fungicides. And we've over you know, millions of years evolved kind of a symbiotic relationship with them, or at least an immunity to them. How do you know that some brand new molecule is going to be safe for us if we haven't, you know, if it hasn't co-evolved with us?
That's a very important question, because we know that even some of the natural substances that we've interacted with for millions of years, that such as peanuts, that some of us are more than happy to eat our peanuts at the ball game or on peanut butter, but others, it's tragically toxic to some folks. So there's
right.
absolutely no substitute for testing and ensuring and making sure that any of our assumptions and any of our best science is always validated by appropriate and thorough testing. That's
right, but what you're saying sounds very much like the same kind of stuff that that you know we have people on this program from Dow Chemical say. Oh, you know, we're very carefully designing our molecules, and we make sure that they're very safe, and we test these things out on poor people in India, and you know, when they kill them, we don't sell them in America, and you know, or whatever. You know, I'm being semi facetious here, but and not just to pick on Dow. I mean, this is just sort of the general chemistry shtick. How is green chemistry different from that?
It's different because it makes the reduction of hazard, the reduction of hazards to humans and the environment and the whole biosphere, a design criterion. Okay, in other words, we've always designed our molecules, whether it's our plastics or our food additives or our textiles, to accomplish a particular performance. Maybe that performance is that it's going to be hard or rubbery. Maybe it's going to be that it's going to be green or blue, and we've always been very good at manipulating our molecules so that it can achieve those performance characteristics. Yet historically, we never had the knowledge, we never had the insight, we never had the ability to design our molecules so that they were intrinsically less toxic. Now we're seeing that we now have that insight.
How do we have that insight? Is it trial and error, try it out and see if something dies? Or are there specific things about molecules that you're working with where you can say, okay, we know that if, you know, we put this hexane group on here, if we put this, you know, hang a hydroxyl group on there, that it's going to do this or that? I mean, what?
That's exactly right. The study of toxicology used to be described as simply descriptive toxicology. That something was toxic. That something was lethal. And when you only know that something is toxic, the best you can do is avoid it. When you start moving into what's called mechanistic toxicology, that is the way it takes different actions in your body, mm-hmm. you're then able to use that knowledge that we now have in ways of designing the molecular architecture so that it cannot undergo those transformations in your body to be toxic. And the same goes for the environment.
We're talking to Paul Anastas, who's the director of the Green Chemistry Institute in Washington, D.C., greenchemistryinstitute.org. Give me some examples, Paul. Convince
me. For instance, we've seen some wonderful work coming out of academic research labs, such as the work of Terry Collins out of Carnegie Mellon University, who is developing molecules that that carry out transformations that have historically used chlorine to do things like disinfect our water or to make make paper, but have resulted in byproducts that are extremely hazardous. He instead develops molecules that use peroxide, which will have the only byproduct being water.
Mm-hmm.
And completely eliminating
free oxygen.
The use of chlorine. That's a wonderful example. We've seen companies that have recrafted the preservatives for our lumber that's used in such things as playgrounds, and totally remove the arsenic and the chromium that has previously been in these preservatives. Now, most people didn't know that their kids were playing on arsenic-laden lumber swing sets, but that's another example of green chemistry that's been used.
So in some ways, it sounds like what you're doing is you're mitigating known harms as opposed to creating new non-harmful compounds. I mean, peroxides have been around forever. We've known about the dangers of arsenic for a good long time. And is that really the focus of it?
No, the focus is creating a new generation of materials. The reason that green chemistry is so fundamental is because basically all we have on this earth is energy and material. And green chemistry is about changing the nature of the materials that we use and the basis of our economy and our society so that it is non-toxic and non-harmful. Mm-hmm. And that includes the material that's used to generate, store, and transport our energy. So it's not about just simply substituting or finding alternatives that exist on the shelf. It's about the innovations of designing new molecules. And I could go on with lists of new paints and new plastics and new agricultural chemicals that are the next generation so that they're intrinsically non-hazardous. But probably the best thing I can do is refer you to the Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge Awards that are given out every year. Mm-hmm. And to see some of the really close to the old saying is the miracles of science, close to miraculous advances.
This is, you're cleaving much more closely to, or hewing much more closely to the precautionary principle than typical American thinking does. Is that an accurate characterization?
Well, certainly. I think that everybody embraces how you look in a visionary way to look at the consequences of the anything you introduce into the environment. There's a wonderful question that's
right, but I mean the European concept that prove this stuff is safe before you introduce it, whereas here in the United States we say go ahead and introduce it, and by the way, if we discover that it's harmful, we'll make you stop. These are fundamentally, they arise out of two different worldviews. Paul?
Yes, the truth is that you're always, when you're doing design, you always recognize the consequences of your actions. And the reason that there's no green geology or green physics, green astronomy, is because chemistry introduces new substances into the world.
Mm.
And when you introduce new substances, you have a responsibility for what those substances are going to do in the environment or interacting with people.
Because they are going to be out there. They are going to interact with things. They are going to interact with people.
Exactly.
Well, that's great. And I'm assuming that you're getting some play out of this thing. It's financially viable.
Absolutely. It's breaking the old logjam between economics and environment. And this
Marvelous.
Is making sure that being good for the environment is economically profitable.
Paul Anastas, director of the Green Chemistry Institute, greenchemistryinstitute.org, the website. Paul, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Keep up the great work. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I ain't no communist, and I ain't no capitalist, and I ain't no socialist, and I ain't no imperialist, and I ain't no Democrat, so ain't no Republican. I only know one party, and this is freedom.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Yes, you too can win $1 billion. Actually, it's even better than that. $1,320,000,000. Minimum of $1,020,000,000. A maximum of $1,320,000,000. You may apply for this. You can do it online. It's at fedgrants.gov. /applicant/aid/om/BAG/RFA, blah, 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 blah. Drop into our live chat room. They'll give you the link to it. It's the Iraq. This is a federal FedGrants.gov. It's a federal funding opportunity. George W. Bush would like to give you $1 billion, the funding opportunity number, RFA-267-06-001. This was published on November 30th, and you have to apply by January 31st. The RFA, the request for applications, will be issued on December 16th, more or less. So you've got a little while to figure out what you're going to say, and it's really quite amazing. It's really quite amazing what they're offering here. Over $1 billion if you can figure out how to stabilize 10 cities in Iraq. It's all it takes. Victoria Jones, certainly you can come up with an idea like that. Would you like $1.32 billion?
Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take a mil. I mean, I'll take whatever you're handing out.
I mean, this is amazing. George W. Bush is offering $1.3 billion through the Agency for International Development to design and implement a social and economic stabilization program impacting 10 strategic cities identified by the United States government as critical to the defeat of the insurgency in Iraq.
That's amazing.
Not too shabby, huh?
Virtually speechless.
It's like, you know, yeah, we have a plan. We have a plan. We had a plan all along. By the way, if anybody has a plan, we'll give them $1 billion.
Fascinating.
So what's going on in Washington? It's right there, by the way, on FedGrants.gov.
The reason I was a minute late calling you is because I just this minute got out of the White House briefing with Scott McClellan, in which we talked about Iraq, we talked about the Vice President's speech this morning, we talked about rendition. I asked a question about, in the Vice President's speech, he said we weren't in Iraq on September the 11th, but the terrorists attacked us anyway.
Right.
And so I asked why the President was still making a connection between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and September the 11th.
And he said?
Oh, he said that he wasn't, and that I'd misheard, and that wasn't what was meant in the statement at all. It was clear that wasn't what was in the statement. And then when I went on to ask whether the President agreed that Saddam Hussein was not involved, he said he'd answered the question ad nauseam.
Yeah.
Ad nauseam. I see. I'm quite insulted.
that is a tough one. But, I mean, here's George W. Bush himself, you know, at a press conference. This is about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. We have no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September the 11th. Yeah.
We have no evidence that Saddam Hussein is involved with the 11th. And I would bet you that probably 95% of Fox News viewers do not realize the President of the United States said that and still stands by it.
Absolutely. Scott McClellan was very keen to talk about the linkage between Zawahiri and Zarqawi, which of course exists and is very strong, but of course they weren't doing anything in Iraq on September the 10th.
No, and they weren't doing anything on September the 11th either. And Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th. But,
right.
Another press circus that you were part of, a witness to, and maybe who knows? We'll see you on MSNBC tonight.
I think some of the questions about rendition may beat me out.
Well, the Italians are really flipped out. I opened the program talking about this. Italy accuses the CIA of ruining its own internal anti-terror investigations, and we have now come out and admitted essentially that we have admitted that we lied to the Italians. We told them that this guy, let me get his name here, Abu Omar. We told them that he had, you know, to stop looking for him in Italy because the Italian CIA or whatever was looking for him. We said to stop looking for him because he's fled to the Balkans, and we know it. And what had happened is we'd kidnapped him.
Unbelievable.
And they're going nuts in Italy. I mean, they're just absolutely going nuts. They are flipped out. They want to charge 22 CIA operatives and arrest them and, you know, question them. And, I mean, we used to have allies, Victoria. We used to have allies.
Yeah, I think we don't.
It's truly, truly amazing, truly tragic. Well, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much for calling in and giving us the scoop, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you. Talk to you later. It's time for our progressive pop quiz. The sixth caller with the correct answer at 866-440-8466 will win a copy of my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Here's the question. Who is the person that the right wing is touting in new commercials as the person who will save Christmas? Who is the guy that the right wing is now saying is the person who will save Christmas? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-8466. 1-866-440-8466 will win an autographed copy of my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, a book about the end of the era of oil. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for Your Brain.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
So hey, there's a new American way. No one's serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A.
Oh, it sounds so nice to be so tough and so
Don't
macho.
Mess with the U.S.
Does it really serve the national interests? Somehow I doubt it. 34 minutes past the hour, coming up on 25 before. Congratulations to Jamie Jagel of Mount Vernon, Washington. There you go. Congratulations, Jamie. Jamie knew that the answer to the question, who is the guy that the right wing is now touting in new commercials across the United States as the man who is going to save Christmas? Who is it? Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. The answer to our progressive pop quiz. Thank you very much, Jamie Jagel. Congratulations. And the book is a copy of my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, along with an impeach Bush button, which rattles around a little bit in the envelope. So it's on its way to you by priority mail. And when you get the thing that rattles, don't worry. It's just an impeach Bush button, along with a book on its way to you. And thanks for playing. Much appreciated. Yep, and that's just, you know, to recap, Sam Alito. Now we've had several weeks of faux news hyping there's a conspiracy to destroy Christmas, and now we have at least a half a dozen different right-wing groups, some of them religious groups, some of them purely political groups, coming out with advertisements that they're playing in congressional districts or senatorial states where senators will have pivotal roles on Alito's confirmation, particularly Colorado, Wisconsin, and West Virginia, running these ads saying, you know, pointing out that Alito is a big supporter of federally paid for or government paid for nativity scenes and that kind of thing, and that he is therefore going to save Christmas. And as a former Senate Republican Senate aide who now helps coordinate conservative judicial confirmation campaigns said, it's something the other side can't really join or debate because they come out looking like the Grinch. Amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. Okay, the national security implications of the free trade beliefs. I don't know how to describe this beyond belief system of the so-called conservatives these days. This is probably one, not probably, this is, in my mind, absolutely one of the most important issues of our day. This is a piece that David Sirota sent out that was originally published in Working for Change blog. I believe David Sirota wrote it. And he pulled together some statistics we really should be paying attention to. Airbus, he says, recently announced that it's working with the Chinese government to potentially build a new airplane manufacturing plant in China. Now, you say, you know, what does it matter to us? Airbus is a European company. Well, except that, you know, American companies are doing the same thing. And what's happening is we're seeing what has happened with the United States going global. People wonder why France is melting down. People wonder why they're having a difficult time in Germany, for example. You're finding, you know, increasingly right-wing governments rising up because the people are freaked out. They know somebody is hurting them. They know somebody's harming them. They know somebody's taking advantage of them. They know that somebody is economically screwing them. They just don't know who. It's the free traders. And I am continually amazed that I get, you know, serious legislators on this program, members of the House and the Senate, who are, you know, are willing to come out and discuss these issues with me and say, you know, well, what about tariffs? Oh, we're never going to go back to that. Well, why not? Well, because everybody has read Thomas Friedman's book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus, or The World is Flat. And Friedman's sort of a semi-liberal. I mean, everybody understands, whether you're liberal or conservative, free trade is a done deal. I'm sorry, it's not. Number one. And number two, it's a disaster. That crazy old coot with the big ears, Ross Perot, remember him? Got portrayed as a crazy old coot in the media, and in some ways he really was a crazy old coot, but I tell you, with regard to trade, he had it right. When Boeing signs purchase orders from China, the Chinese government regularly requires the company to produce more and more of its parts in China. Now, we don't say to, for example, Toyota, hey, if you're going to build cars in the United States, the onboard computers have to be made in the United States. No, they can make them in China. They can make them in Japan. We don't say that to Ford, for that matter. In fact, large chunks of the cars made in the, quote, made in the USA are actually not made in the USA. These so-called free traders in the U.S. Congress are ignoring bipartisan concerns. They, for example, they just rammed through Congress. Bernie Sanders was on, you know, talking about this sometime back. Rammed through Congress billions of dollars in loan guarantees to Westinghouse. Westinghouse is a British-owned company. Now, why did we give a British-owned company billions of your tax dollars and mine to do something? What was it that was so important that we had to give them billions of dollars to build nuclear reactors in China? Now, can you explain to me this? The reality is that we allow Westinghouse, which used to be an American company before it was bought by the Brits, or a group of Brits, we let them set up a lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. They can go walk down to K Street and they can buy a lobbyist, and they, you know, by proxy, buy legislators just like anybody else can. And so the money is going to go through Westinghouse directly to the state-run company in China, the communists, who, according to Reuters, have been quoting Reuters now, accused of transferring sensitive technology to Iran and Pakistan. In other words, your tax, everybody's hysterical about Iran and Pakistan having nuclear weapons and nuclear technology, and your tax dollars and mine are going to go to Westinghouse to build a nuclear power plant in China, who is known to share nuclear secrets with Iran and Pakistan. Tell me what's wrong with this picture. As David Sirota notes, free traders in France and Germany are now, according to Reuters, quote, and again, quoting Reuters, campaigning for the European Union to drop an embargo on arms sales to China that was imposed after the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing, in which tanks were sent to crush pro-democracy protests. Even despite the fact that the UN recently reported, the United Nations just reported, China still employs some of the most violent and brutal anti-democratic practices on its own population among nations of the world. Now, you've got guys who, men and women who, back in the 50s, if you had said communist China, they, you know, before Nixon opened up China, right? If you'd be back in the 50s, they would have gone, what? Communist China, you can't have that. Communist China, we know where it's at. There's money to be made. It's like it doesn't matter whether it harms America's interest. That's no longer part of the equation. It doesn't matter whether it wipes out our middle class. That's no longer part of the equation. What matters is whether it's going to enhance the bottom line of a large multinational corporation. And if it will, if it's going to grant billions of dollars to that multinational corporation, and that multinational corporation can turn around and siphon a few million bucks off to hand off to their politician friends in Washington, D.C., then fine. I mean, you had Duke Cunningham, Randy Cunningham. He's living in a yacht. He's driving to work in Congress in a Rolls Royce for years, and nobody says, "Hey, Randy, what's going on?" Because everybody just figures, "Hey, that's the way it's done." I mean, he had to get outed back in his own home district in San Diego, a local newspaper pointing out the fact that his house that was worth just a couple $100,000 that a contractor paid, you know, nearly $1 million for, and then sold it at a loss. That contractor, by the way, running a hospitality suite for years. Military contractor Brent Wilkes, this is from the Center for American Progress, named as co-conspirator number one in the Randy Duke Cunningham case, was a political operative who knew how to grease the wheels to gain influence with lawmakers. Wilkes's contacts reached to the top of government, including the CIA's third in command, Kyle Dusty Fago, Wilkes's best friend since high school. He was able to, quote, identify which politicians should be given donations, end quote, in order to gain lucrative contracts. He also gave generously to legislators. He handed $100,000 to Cunningham and, quote, ran a hospitality suite with several bedrooms in Washington, first in the Watergate Hotel and then in the Western Grand near Capitol Hill, end quote. A hospitality suite? What's he working with, Heidi Fleiss? I'm telling you, this when this thing starts to unravel, some strange stuff is going to, if it unravels, keep in mind, again, this Randy Cunningham was a Republican. And which is not to say that there aren't some Democrats involved in this, but it seems that the corruption at its steepest level is with the Republicans. So will there be an investigation? No. And it all comes back, again, to who's making the money. And here we're talking, Eisenhower warning us about the military-industrial complex, it was nothing compared to what's going on now. You are seeing corruption that absolutely defies not just the will of the American people, but what's good for the United States of America. And I'm sorry, call me old-fashioned, but I really think that the citizens of a nation should be first and foremost concerned with what's best for their nation. I mean, ultimately, yes. Yeah, I mean, that's just the bottom line. And that's not happening here with free trade. 45 minutes past three.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, there's a change taking place way on the mountains. Acid rain is falling on the leaves. And down in Brazil, the fires are burning still. How are we gonna breathe without them trees? So let's leave some blue up above us.
Sounds like a plan.
Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only as tomorrow. Let's save some for tomorrow. Leave it and pass it on down.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking of investments, Intel is going to invest $1 billion in new chip-making operations. Intel, a company that, American company, started out here, grew here, got big here, a lot of its customers here, but it's going to spend that $1 billion in India. India, and this from the BBC, Intel, the world's largest chip maker, plans to invest $1 billion in India over the next 5 years. Intel has an R&D center in Bangalore that produces software to drive its microchips, computers, and networks. Firms like Intel are expanding in India because the wages of software engineers are a fraction of what they cost in the U.S. Welcome to the wonderful world of unbridled free trade. John in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, our number 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M, 440-8466. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, John?
Hey, I was just calling a comment. You were talking before about posse comitatus and martial law.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was a function of the National Guard and not the U.S. Army.
National order?
Yeah, if they would.
That was the whole point of it. The National Guard is actually under the direct. In each state, the National Guard is under the control of the governor of the state,
right?
And therefore, I believe it was earlier in this national program. It might have been earlier in my local program. We had this conversation. I frankly sometimes mix them up, but somebody pointed out that, in fact, it was a woman whose husband was in law enforcement, that it's a whole lot easier if you're going to repress people, if you're going to play the role of an occupier and trash communities and whatnot. It's a lot easier if you don't live in that community. It's a whole lot harder if you do live in that community.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, one of the reasons that a lot of cities around, municipalities around the United States have rules that say that their police officers have to live in the community that they're policing. And the whole point of the National Guard was, you know, it was sort of the outgrowth of the old militias that we had, the local militias, and the whole point of it was that they are local. And you're right, the National Guard can be called out without an act of Congress and without invoking or violating posse comitatus to deal with local insurrections, as arguably it was at Kent State in Ohio way back in the 60s.
Right. It makes you wonder why there's so many National Guard over in Iraq right now.
Well, that question has been raised. Was it to get them out of the way so that we would have an excuse to use the federal forces? I frankly don't think so. I think it's just the incredible pug ugly incompetence of the Bush administration, that they are just, you know, that they had no idea that they were going to end up needing this many troops and they couldn't get them anyplace else. Although, you know, who knows?
I agree with that too. And have you ever done a show on the Carlyle Group?
Yeah, I have.
Them at all?
Yeah, I have. We did a really good in-depth look at the Carlyle Group about a year and a half ago. It's been a while, though. It's worth revisiting,
okay,
John.
I must have missed that show. Yeah. Yeah. My understanding, George Bush Sr. is on the board of directors.
Yeah. Well, he was. Yeah, he was.
Defense conglomeration of major defense industries.
Yeah, Bush Sr., right after he left the presidency, not only got on the board of directors of Carlyle Group, but was one of their major frontmen, and the Bush family has made millions, if not more,
and not
from
only
the
that, but one of the major investors is the Bin Laden family.
Yeah, well, it was actually. What happened was after 9/11, the Bin Laden family divested themselves from their investments in the Carlyle Group because
okay.
It was politically uncomfortable for them. Yeah,
but
they were for a long time. Well, I mean, you know, you want a bigger connection? Look at Salim Bin Laden. Salim Bin Laden was Osama's half brother,
mm-hmm.
And when George W. Bush was, you know, in his 30s in Texas, and he had this little oil company, Arbusto.
The one that went belly up.
Well, it was ready to go belly up, and it got bailed out. It got bailed out with money from Salim Bin Laden, Osama Bin Laden's half-brother. And when authorities in Texas started looking into it, because it looked like there might have been some hanky-panky, Salim Bin Laden died in a small plane crash in Texas.
There are a lot of small plane crashes in this country.
Yeah, strangest thing. John, thanks for the call.
Hey, well,
good to hear from
you. The last comment I had, too, you were talking about Ross Perot before. And
yeah.
I had an old tape from the 92 debates with Bush and Clinton and Ross Perot on it.
Yeah.
And pretty much everything Ross Perot said on there, it was spot on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was the only one telling the truth. And,
I thought
you know,
he was crazy at the time, but when he said that giant sucking sound you hear is your job,
you got
the
it.
Country.
You got it. And,
right
and Ross Perot was dead on right, and Bill Clinton sold us down the tubes, and George Bush would have done so if he could have. John in Huntsville, and thanks for the call, John. John in Huntsville, Texas. Hey, John, we've got about a minute and a half left. What's up?
Yes, continuing your discussion of corruption, but this will lead to a question which I would really like to have an answer to. And this is, what if Bush and his cronies, for example, their moral and political loyalty is actually to the multinational system rather than the U.S. Constitution or the U.S. people.
Well, that's the point that I've been making, John. I believe
exactly.
that is the case.
And it's
I believe that is the case. And
it's an interesting prism to use to look at what they're doing continually. Now, here is my
question. I think there's a history for that, too. If you look at Prescott Bush supporting Hitler until Roosevelt forced him to stop and took away his bank, I mean, you know, in the 1940s.
Exactly. And, of course, there was that attempted coup of Roosevelt.
Yeah.
It too. But here's my question that I'm interested in today. And that is, I ran across a piece of information that indicated that in June of this year, that Bush created something called the National Security Service. And it's something like a secret police that is exclusively governed by the executive branch. And with no congressional oversight.
John,
did
I'm going to
really
have to do some. I can't answer that one off the top of my head, frankly. I'm sorry I don't have all the details right here.
Can you look into it?
I will look into it, and we will get it on this program. Thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you, John, and thanks for listening to us down there in Huntsville, Texas. The National Security Service, and David is on it, and I remember seeing stories to that effect, so we will follow up on that. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for clean elections. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Tom Hartman radio program, 6 minutes past the hour. In the last hour, somebody asked about the new domestic intelligence service within the United States, the BBC headline. Which is a little different from that of the CNN headline. The CNN headline was basically, thank you. The CNN headline was Bush creates National Security Service. And President Bush on Wednesday directed the creation of a new National Security Service within the FBI. This was in December 6th. On the other hand, the BBC report, headline, Bush sets up domestic spy service. U.S. President George W. Bush has ordered the creation of a domestic intelligence service within the FBI as part of a package of 70 new security measures, And John Negroponte basically is in charge of the whole thing. Good old Death Squad John. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. Not, frankly, I think a good sign for democracy in the United States. Today is National Call into Congress Day. Bring the troops home. Several telephone numbers for Congress. The main number for the switchboard, 202-225-3121. 202-225-3121. If you want to call Congress toll free, you can call. There's two 888 numbers, 888-818-6641. That's 818-6641. Or 355-3588, 888-355-3588. And Tom Andrews is with us with winwithoutwarus.org. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us about the Win Without War program and the National Call into Congress Day.
Well, Tom, we're a national coalition of 40 organizations, largely national membership-based groups, ranging from MoveOn.org to True Majority to Working Assets, NAACP, National Organization of Women, Sierra Club, a number of groups who may not have the Iraq war or even national security as one of their primary issues, but everyone agrees that this is a disaster. It's affecting all of us, and we've got to pull together and join together in trying to stop this madness in Iraq and around the world if we're going to be able to focus on any of the priorities that we care about. So today, we've joined up with United for Peace and Justice, another coalition that is largely of anti-war groups, and we are calling Congress, and we're telling them from one end of the country or the other to stop this war, to hold this administration accountable, to make it clear to them that we are going to hold them accountable for allowing the deceptions and this extraordinary debacle that we're now in the midst of, and that we need an exit strategy from Iraq that begins to bring our troops home immediately and gets them home in 2006.
Well said. And the telephone numbers in Congress, once again, if you'd like to call, and these are directly to the switchboard at Capitol Hill. If you're not sure who your representative is in the House of Representatives, simply give them your zip code, and they can look it up and tell you who that person is. If you're not sure who your senators are, tell them what state you're from, and they will tell you. Every one of us has two senators and one member of Congress, and you just ask the switchboard. Don't be ashamed. Don't be embarrassed. A lot of people are not absolutely certain who represents them. The telephone number 202-225-3121, and something you should be doing on a regular basis, in fact, 202-225-3121 or toll-free 888-818-6641, 818-6641. Tom Andrews, you're a former congressman. You represented the great state of Maine as a Democrat in the House of Representatives. You understand the political implications of this. Today, Dick Cheney came out and said for us to set a timetable or to withdraw from Iraq would be unwise in the extreme, I believe, was the phrase he used. the political pressure that is being cranked up by the White House on this thing is absolutely enormous. And yet at the same time, we're hearing from folks like Stephen Hadley on the weekend shows that the Bush administration is planning to pull down the troops. It looks to me like what they're going to do is declare victory and come home, but do it on their own timetable and in their own way and take credit for them themselves. What's your take on the political calculus in all this?
Well, it's just that, Tom. First of all, it's a political calculus. It's based on nothing other than where these polling numbers are going. And, of course, the administration are worried sick as they look at their Republican base in Congress and see their base being eroded by the pressure that members of Congress are in, particularly Republican members of Congress, by constituents who want them to begin to do their job and hold the administration accountable. So I think the plan, from all I can gather, listening to the speech that he delivered at the Naval Academy last week and this so-called national strategy for victory on the one hand, and then these indications that they want to start pulling troops out on the other, they're going to do the minimal amount that they believe they need to do politically in order to stop the bleeding, as they say in Washington, and try to convince people that the Bush strategy for Iraq, first of all, is a strategy, and secondly, is working. So regardless of what goes on the ground, they're going to pull things, you know, slowly begin to pull troops out enough so that they can inch those polling numbers up adequately enough to protect their members of Congress facing re-election. The problem is, of course, if you talk to people who are knowledgeable about what's going on the ground, and you talk to former three- or four-star generals about what's happening with our military, you realize that it is precisely the problem. That is, the troops that we have on the ground right now in Iraq are fueling this insurgency. They're causing greater instability. 82% of the people of Iraq want the U.S. military out. 45% say that the attacks on our troops are perfectly justified. And only 1%, now interestingly, I believe that U.S. forces are responsible for any improvement in security that may occur in this or that neighborhood. In other words, Iraqis want us out. The insurgency is being fueled and is fueling, being fueled by this military occupation, as it's seen by the Iraqis, and they are getting support from an Iraqi public that just wants the U.S. out. And of course, if you listen to the generals on the ground in Iraq, they're telling us that for every insurgent that U.S. forces kill, 5 replace them. So until you can change that basic dynamic, demilitarize the situation in Iraq, pull our troops out, you can create the stability that you need and begin to have a chance of rebuilding Iraq the way the public wants it. But if you go the direction of George Bush and you believe in these falsehoods that were being fed again last week that things are in fact improving, and then allow this slow, steady trickle to appease the polls, we're going to find ourselves deeper and deeper and deeper in the mess in Iraq, and more Americans are going to be killed, and more innocent Iraqis are going to be killed.
Yeah, it's the Vietnam scenario, and we're radicalizing the Iraqis. I mean, you say for every insurgent killed, 5 will take their place. I would say for every insurgent killed, one large extended family is devastated, and 5 people will become so radicalized that they'll join the insurgency from that family. These are not just insurgents. These are citizens of Iraq, by and large, who have brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers and children in some cases, and uncles and aunts and cousins and nephews and nieces, and everybody, you know, gets upset when a member of their family has been killed. I mean, we are not seen as the liberal. In fact, this is the big point that really I'm surprised is not being driven home more effectively in the United States. Tom Andrews, speaking with former Congressman Tom Andrews of Maine, National Director to Win Without War, winwithoutwar.us.org. And that is that you can't have an insurgency without popular support.
Right.
I mean, if the KKK in the United States, which is still around, if the KKK tomorrow afternoon was to decide that they were going to go out and start killing black people, for example, or just killing police officers, for example, and we were to have what you could describe as an insurgency in the United States, the KKK runs around and starts killing people, it would last about a week, because Americans who live near the people everybody knows who everybody is, their neighbors would turn them in.
That's right.
And you can't have an insurgency without popular support. And How is it that most Americans have not made that political calculus? Or are they starting to, and is that why Dick Cheney is referring to these people as terrorists instead of insurgents?
Well, that's exactly what's happening. And, of course, the vice president has been, it's just unbelievable how reckless his rhetoric continues to be, basically calling those of us who are calling for an accountability in Iraq and a change of direction in Iraq, basically unpatriotic and traitors. But, you know, you as you follow those polling numbers within Iraq and you see how many people want us out, the insurgency, the size of the attacks, the sophistication of the attacks, we've gone from 150 insurgent attacks a week to 700 a week. The daily death toll of American servicemen and women have gone from one per day to nearly four per day since the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. And then when you listen to the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Porter Goss, trying to explain why terrorism attacks are up since 9/11, they'll tell you that Iraq has become terrorism university. It is now a major training ground for insurgents to go, for terrorists to go in and get hands-on experience with terrorist attacks that they can unleash all over the world.
Yeah, we have to wrap this up, but I thank you for being with us. Former Congressman Tom Andrews, the National Director of Win Without War, winwithoutwarus.org, the website. Call your member of Congress now, 888-818-6641, toll free. Call them now and tell them to get us out. Tom, thanks for being with us. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harper.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
We've taken all you give. It's getting hard to make a living. Mr. President, the pity on working man.
And welcome back, my friends. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com on the Internet. And welcome back to the program. Ex-general calls for Iraq pullout. This in the news. The U.S. general who used to head the National Security Agency, the NSA, the NSA, the guy who used to head this thing, says the only way to stabilize the Middle East is to leave Iraq. Retired three-star General William Odom, writing for NeimanWatchdog.org, wrote that while President George W. Bush wants to bring democracy and stability to the Middle East, the only way to achieve that goal is for the U.S. Armed Forces to get out of Iraq now. We'll come back to this in a little bit, but once again, the phone number for Congress, 202-225-3121 or 888-818-6641. Nancy Anton is with us with NewsHounds.us, www.newshounds.us. They watch Fox, so we don't have to. Boy, it's tough work. It's really kind of a grungy job, but somebody's got to do it. And Nancy, I'm so pleased that you are.
Thanks, Tom.
What is the meme of the day on Fox News?
Well, there's one thing from last week that I wanted to mention because it addresses an issue that I think is really important, and it's racism.
Mm-hmm.
December 1st, there was a ceremony with Bush at the White House signing a bill about a statue of Rosa Parks.
Right.
Guess which station didn't cover it live?
Fox.
Bingo.
Yeah, you mean which network? Fox News, yeah.
Exactly.
So,
CNN and MSNBC both covered it live.
Now, do you see that as racism or as just, perhaps misplaced priorities in the context of what's an important story? I mean, did they have something that they thought was more important that they were breaking?
Yeah. Bridget Quinn was talking to Robert Shapiro about kids and drugs.
I see. Yeah, that really...
That was crucial.
Urgent stuff, yeah.
Right, really, and then Brett Baer did an interview with Khalilzad, who's the ambassador to Afghanistan.
Right.
I'm sorry, to Iraq.
Right.
And that was also more important.
Yeah. That's fascinating. One of the things that I find interesting, Nancy Anton, with NewsHounds.us, is that Fox has been drumming up this war against Christmas for weeks now. We talked about this last week, in fact.
And it's still going on, and it's invading more and more of the programs on Fox News Channel.
Well, what's particularly interesting is that Sam Alito now is being rolled out as, and you may not, I don't know if this has hit Fox News yet, but the ads are starting to hit senatorial states where senators are, you know, swing senators for the Alito nomination, Colorado among them, starting to hit this week and next to suggest that Sam Alito is the guy who's going to save Christmas. He is the one who's going to save Christmas. Christmas is under attack, and Sam Alito will save him because he has ruled from the bench that Christmas decorations can be put in public places and paid for with taxpayer dollars, and the children in public schools can be forced to carry home Christian religious tracts to their families.
Well, I'm glad you brought the topic up because we've caught a couple of great hypocrisy things. Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah.
Okay. Was selling holiday ornaments on his website, not Christmas ornaments.
Right, he's changed that now.
And Fox had a holiday party scheduled, not a Christmas party.
Incredible.
This is the station that has been blaring 24/7 about the war on Christmas, and they themselves are using holiday.
Well, it really exposes the cleavage, the line, the problem of how do you as an institution, or as an individual, as a talk show host, as a network, how do you respect the fact that not everybody in this country celebrates Christmas? In fact, a sizable minority of people in this country don't celebrate Christmas, and at the same time, wish people happy holidays. I mean, because there's several major religions have holidays around this time,
right.
Including the old pagan holidays. And so, how do you do that? Well, the simple way is you say happy holidays, and everybody agrees that, for Christians that means happy Merry Christmas, and for Jews it means happy Hanukkah, and for pagans it means happy Yule, and pick your religion. And Fox is doing this internally, but they're not doing it externally. It's bizarre. And I'm increasingly convinced that this has to do with pushing Sam Alito, although they have done this in previous years. So maybe it's just opportunism.
And they also did it last spring around Easter time.
Easter. Didn't that coincide with rolling out what's-his-name's movie?
Passion of the Christ, yes.
Right, which Bill O'Reilly was a big investor in.
Yes.
And Bill O'Reilly made millions on that movie. He was one of the larger investors with Mel Gibson in that movie, and he was one of the guys who turned that movie into this big controversial thing.
Right.
And we'll
have to see if they do it again this coming Easter. But last year there was a minor blip. It wasn't as big as the Christmas.
Yeah.
Barrage.
Yeah. What they did was they kind of turned it into a so-called war on the movie, on Mel Gibson's movie.
Yes.
Yeah, and amazing.
But they had all kinds of stories about how the Easter Bunny couldn't be at a shopping mall, you know.
Yeah. Any other interesting memes coming out of Fox here, Nancy, very quickly?
Nothing in particular. It's the war on Christmas all over the place.
That's it. Wall to wall.
Well, they have trotted out a Swift Boat vet.
A Swift Boat vet. Oh,
yes. Yes, John O'Neill is back on Fox.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, you'll have to tell us about that next week.
That
is amazing stuff. Nancy Anton, newshounds.us. They watch Fox, so you don't have to. And thank goodness for that. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And the lonely voice of you cries, what is true?
Well, you're not going to get it from the bushes.
A little boy of 3 sitting on the floor looks up and says, Daddy, what is war? Son, that's when people fight and die. A little boy of 3 says, Daddy, why? Young man of 17 in Sunday school, being taught the golden rule. And by the time another year's gone around, it may be his turn to lay his life down. Can you blame the voice of you for asking what is true?
Welcome back, my friends. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. It's 25 minutes before the hour, and Wesley Clark has a fascinating piece in the New York Times today. We'll get to that in just a moment. First, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. And Carl in Tukwila, Washington. Am I pronouncing that right, Carl?
Yep.
Hey, Carl. What's up?
Yep.
You're live on the air.
I am. Well, that's great. Listen, I want America back. I want people to...
You and me both.
There were things that made America attractive, and so therefore everybody wanted to come here. Okay? But now we've got all these resources spread all over the world, getting in everybody's business. Our roads are falling apart. Kids are bringing guns to school. We don't even have a railroad system. They're trying to cut that. What's going on here?
I know. Our airlines are going bankrupt. Our transportation infrastructure is falling apart. Our schools are in crisis. It just goes on and on and on. And what's going on is that 25 years ago, Ronald Reagan came out and said the 17, 18, 19, I forget the number, most scary words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And everybody laughed and said, oh, yeah, he's right. And he started campaigning against the government that he was leading and thus campaigning against the idea that citizens should play some role in society, in governance of society, that the idea that on which this country was founded, of a democratic republic, of we the people getting together and saying, you know, there are some things that we collectively are going to do to support and help and aid and ourselves, that came under assault, under attack under Reagan. At the same time, he also said, you know, this stuff about protecting us from big corporations who want to prey on small businesses and wipe out local communities, that's, you know, we need to get rid of that. We need to deregulate that. And 25 years of conservative warfare on the American middle class, on the environment, on anything that doesn't enhance profitability of multinational corporations and the big oil guys who brought Reagan into office. Remember, his first official act of office was to remove the solar collectors that Jimmy Carter put on top of the White House. 25 years of that has brought us where we are today.
It's awful because now it's like we really don't know which way to turn. And now the country's incredibly divided. You know, you got people that have come here as immigrants. No one taught them what it means to be an American so that therefore they don't have to worry about it. They've brought their own brand of crime with them. I saw this thing on 60 Minutes about this gang of 13, and they're all from South America, and they're all raping, pillaging, killing, and destroying. Meanwhile, you have people that come here that don't even know. When I went to school, there used to be a class called citizenship.
Yeah, civics. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I absolutely agree with you, Carl. You're spot on, and you have identified a huge problem. And I'll tell you, this is, well, for example, Rush Limbaugh. You remember Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt brought us minimum wage laws, worker protection laws, the ability of workers to unionize, 1935, the Wagner Act and the National Labor Relations Act, Social Security, 1935-1936. Franklin Roosevelt brought us those things.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
That has been the conservative mantra for 25 years. And it's not about, gee, let's get Americans more involved. Here's Paul Weyrich. Paul Weyrich, one of the major architects of the conservative so-called revolution in America, talking before a congregation of Republicans, a conservative a Republican Christian group, just laying it right out.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
I don't want everybody to vote, he says. And that's what that's the great lesson of negative campaign advertising, is that you do negative campaign advertising, it doesn't increase your numbers, it drives down the number of people who actually show up at the polls. And then you get this on top of the demagoguery like this.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
There you go, yeah. Undermining it by simply telling you the truth, just laying it out. I mean, there it is. It's right there, and all because of the incredible arrogance of an administration that says, you know, it's me, not you. I'm the one who gets to decide. Well, in his own words,
you said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you. So, and in the meantime, you know, we're ignoring what's going on all over the world. I could go on and on. I won't. Timothy in Petaluma, California. Hey, Timothy, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just wanted to tell you that the U.S. Congress is cutting money to pay for peacekeepers in Darfur. Already 400,000 have died there in an ongoing genocide. 3 million displaced people are at risk.
And yeah, this is stuff that makes Saddam Hussein look like he worked for the Red Cross.
Right. Yeah, and President Bush has called it a genocide, but right now that Congress is thinking about cutting $50 million from the Darfur Peace and Accountability Act for the African Union forces that are the only thing standing between the refugees in the camps and these armed militias who go about killing humanitarian aid workers and refugees who've had been forced to flee their villages. So.
Yeah.
We're asking people to please call the Capitol switchboard at 202-224-3121, and they'll transfer you to your senator or representative.
Yeah, the number I have, by the way, is 225-3121. Maybe your number is just as good, but I can tell you for sure, 225-3121, area code 202 will get you there.
At darfurgenocide.org,
okay,
you can get a lot of this information.
And how do you spell Darfur? Isn't there an H in there?
D-A-R-F-U-R.
D-A-R. Okay, I had it wrong. Okay, great. D-A-R-F-U-R. Timothy, thank you very much for the call. Thank you for
doing this.
Sure, you're welcome. For raising that issue. I mean, this is just, you know, on and on. It goes, well, anyhow, here's Wesley Clark. He's got this new piece. This is a Dateline Doha, Qatar, or Qatar, depending on where you are and where you're from. While the Bush administration and its critics escalated the debate last week over how long our troops should stay in Iraq, I was able to see the issue through the eyes of America's friends in the Persian Gulf. And then he goes on to point out that basically you can't kill enough people in a country that the rest of them will say, okay, we're on your side now. It just doesn't work. There are no military solutions. He says just the bottom line, as one prominent Kuwaiti academic explained to me, in the Muslim world, the best way to deal with your enemies has always been to assimilate them. You never succeed in killing them all, and by trying to, you just make more enemies. Instead, you must woo them to rejoin society and the government. Military pressure should be used in a calibrated way to help in the wooing. He says, if this critique is correct and it's difficult to argue against it, then we must face its implications. Staying the course risks a slow and costly departure of American forces, with Iraq increasingly factionalized and aligned with Iran. 2 years ago, well, perhaps more than 2 years ago, on this program, right after the war, right after the invasion of Iraq started, Scott Ritter came on this program, and one of several appearances that, you know, we used to have him on fairly regularly, and although he's, you know, essentially saying the same thing, and that is that, you know, I said, who's winning the war in Iraq? And he said, Iran. And it is just so obvious. Iran had some very specific goals in that region. They wanted Saddam Hussein out. They lost 1 million people fighting against him. They tried to get him out. They wanted to get rid of him. So you had the Iranians who wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein. You had Osama bin Laden who wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Osama bin Laden, after the war in Afghanistan, where we helped him build the Mujahideen and evict the Soviets, returned triumphant to Saudi Arabia, his homeland, and said, you know, in Iraq, our next-door neighbor, I mean, they share a huge border with Iraq, Saudi Arabia does. And in Saudi Arabia, our border to the east, our neighbor to the east, it's being run by Saddam Hussein, and he's a secularist. He doesn't require men to wear beards. He allows people to drink alcohol. The women can marry. They on their own accord. They can have jobs. They can drive. They can show their elbows. We've got to stop him. And he gets his married band together to try to invade Iraq. And the Saudis stopped him, and they expelled him to the Sudan. So you've got Iran wanting to get rid of Saddam Hussein. You've got Osama bin Laden wanting to get rid of Saddam Hussein. So what do? We get rid of Saddam Hussein. Who wins? Certainly not the United States. Now, that said, our oil companies seem to be doing fairly well, and there's a big plan now moving forward to make sure that our oil companies do very well. But other than that, I'm telling you, This is the big winner in this thing, as Wesley Clark points out, although he's not willing to call for a pullout because he wants to run for president again. And it's like, what's her name? Hillary Clinton yesterday calling for a flag-burning amendment. I mean, you know, excuse me. Pardon my cynicism. But in any case, the main point that he makes is a brilliant one. It's a very good one. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit www.gotomeeting.com. Click the radio microphone and use promo code America. That's gotomeeting.com, radio microphone, promo America. Discover the power of web conferencing with GoToMeeting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes.
You tell them
watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
One of my favorite things to do, actually. Welcome back. I live in a house that's on a river, actually in the river. So I have a particular affection for that. Our house is on pontoons, and the river flows underneath it. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. General Odom, Lieutenant General William Odom, the guy who was the head of the National Security Agency, one of the most respected U.S. military analysts in the world, a major figure at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. Hudson Institute, one of the more prominent conservative think tanks, wrote recently, and I quote, "We have seen most of our allies stand aside and engage in schadenfreude over our painful bog down in Iraq. Winston Churchill's glib observation, 'the only thing worse than having allies is having none,' was once again vindicated. There is no chance that our allies will join us in Iraq. Iraq is the worst place to fight a battle for regional stability. Whose interests were best served by the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the first place? It turns out that Iran and Al-Qaeda benefited the most, and that continues to be true every day U.S. forces remain there." This is General William Odom from a week ago, saying something that, you know, a lot of us have been saying for 2.5-3 years. 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, our telephone number. And Nick in San Diego, California. Hey, Nick, what's up?
How's it going?
Great. What's on your mind?
Well, I think we're going to get destroyed in 2008 if we put Hillary up there.
I'm not arguing with you, Nick.
I don't see who else we can put up there. I think if Hillary runs in 2008, you know, everything that we're doing is for naught, because we're just going to have to go another 4 more years of the same old, same old.
You know, I just don't know. There's a lot of time. We got two and a half years here before that happens. And I have to say, as I've said before, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee of the Democratic Party, I will support her, because, you know, anything is better than a Republican.
But
there are some very good candidates out there. I think John Edwards is a very good candidate. I think Howard Dean's an excellent candidate. I think Barbara Boxer is an excellent candidate.
Right.
You know, there's no shortage. Russ Feingold. There's some really, truly brilliant statesmen and women out there who would make appropriate candidates for president on the Democratic side. I'm not a big fan of Hillary, but I'm also not going to trash her.
Well, we can't kid ourselves into thinking that she's not going to get the nomination, because I'm thoroughly convinced that she will get the nod. I'm just saying that once she does get the nod, she's got so many skeletons in her closet, and the way she's positioned herself on this war, she's going to lose, and she's going to lose big.
Well, that may be or may not be, Nick. It's, you know, those of us who are political junkies sometimes see a whole lot of trees and miss the whole forest. You know, it's to belabor an old cliche. Keep in mind, the vast majority of Americans are really not paying that kind of close attention.
Who do you think the Republicans are going to put up?
I don't really know. At this point, my guess would be if the thing swings moderate, that they'll put up the Chuck Hagel, the guy who was the former president of ESNS, the voting machine company.
Right.
He's certainly positioning himself for that. There's a number, Rudy Giuliani. I mean, there's a number of possibilities. Dick Morris is running around talking about Condi Rice. I think that's a stretch.
Do you think there's any chance of Mr. Cheney doing it?
No.
You don't think he'll do it?
No. I think that they're going to try and trot out John McCain. There's the McCain faction. But frankly, I think that the Bush dynasty is going to continue to hold control over it. And so that Jeb can run in another 8-9 years from now, in 20,
so,
whatever.
So if Hillary wins, we'll basically just be going from the Bushes to the Clintons to the Bushes to the Clintons.
Yep. And it wouldn't surprise me if that's what happens. Nick, thanks a lot for the call. It's an issue that we'll have plenty of time to talk about as time goes on. Armand in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armand, we just got about 30 seconds here. What's up?
First off, I'd never, ever vote for Hillary Bush. Secondly, Halliburton, Kellogg Brown Root, Martin Marietta, Bechtel, all oil cartels, Bush's blind trust. What's the question?
Okay. I don't know. What is the question, Armand?
What's the real reasons Bush doesn't want to pull out of Iraq? And one other point.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you.
Saddam Hussein is the one that broke the OPEC embargo against this country, I believe, in 73 or 74. And look how he was rewarded for doing that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the crime that he is on trial for right now in Iraq, just 5 months later, Don Rumsfeld went over and shook his hand and congratulated him for.
So did Bob Dole.
I mean, he was putting down an assassination attempt against him. I'm not justifying what he did.
What he did, though? Let's be honest. You know what he did? He flipped his finger at the international bankers and started going on his own money system.
Well, there's a lot of folks who believe that, and it makes sense to me.
Kennedy did it.
Yeah.
Kennedy did it. What happened to him?
Well, I'm not there with you on that, Armand, but I'm not sure that Kennedy was planning on doing that.
No, Kennedy did it.
What?
He started printing money.
Oh.
Start printing our own money.
Yeah, well, you could argue Nixon did it, too.
Let the Fed private cartel out.
I know, and there are people who say that, Nixon took us off the gold standard and therefore Watergate, and that's why they had to bring him down. I mean, there's no shortage of conspiracy theories around that stuff.
No, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's a fact that Kennedy started printing our own money. And
yeah.
That's where they said, just like Hitler, he wasn't a bad guy until he started printing his own money.
Okay, all righty. Point made, and thank you, Armand. It's always nice to hear from you. And I would say that, when Saddam Hussein came along and said, well, we're going to denominate our oil in euros, it did cause some consternation here. But I'm convinced George Bush had planned to attack Iraq in 1999. He told his biographer he was going to do that. And he told him he was going to do it for one simple reason, to get power for Republicans and for himself. And he did. And he did. And all this other stuff, Halliburton and Bechtel and the oil cartels and everything else, it's all frosting on the cake. It's money for Cheney. But for Bush, it was all about power. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.